This is the When You Die podcast. If it has to do with death and dying, we're talking about it. Today's host is Kelly Edwards.
Jill Chandler has had many roles in her lifetime: musician, performer, wife, a mother. And in 2013, Jill Chandler became a widow when her husband Donald died from a brain tumor. Jill talks to us today from her home in Prince Edward Island, which is on the east coast of Canada. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Kelly. How are you?
I'm good. And you are something else, which I'm going to just put out there right now for full disclosure. You are also a friend of mine, so this is not an impartial interview. And just so that we let listeners know that this could be an emotional journey for both of us. So, you know, we're just going to see what happens. So, Jill, I want to go to talk about your life as Jill Chandler before Donald. Let's talk about the things that you did that you loved.
I loved music, and it was a big part of my identity. I was very social, perhaps too social. I performed in the dinner theater. I lived in Halifax and was kind of just trying to make a go of things. I was beginning to write songs and perform them locally, and I guess starting to believe that I perhaps could have a path in that industry.
And then you met Donald.
And then I met Donald.
What was it about Donald that you thought this is the guy?
Well, he was incredibly handsome. He had a kind of, I won't say aloofness, but there was something about him that just, he just seemed unique. Oddly enough, I met him when he was a doorman or a bouncer at the Marquee, a local bar in Hell's Kitchen, and I would be there as a patron. Mm-hmm. And we just would interact, and he just had this shyness and sweetness about him, and we just instantly became the very best of friends.
And then husband and wife.
And then, yes, eventually husband and wife. But the friendship, the best friend part was the biggest connector. And there were moments, times throughout our relationship that maybe we took little pauses, but we could never stay away from one another because it was those best friend qualities. I just couldn't be without my best friend, and he felt the same. His mom reminds me of a time when we broke up that he was sad and just said, "Mom, I can't be without her. She's my best friend."
Aww. And then you started to grow a family. So you had three children.
Yes, three children, Rowan and Cooper and Darcy.
And then everything changed because you have a vision of your life and where your family is headed. And then it completely gets dismantled in a second.
It completely got dismantled in a matter of, well, I mean, I remember the very second that it got dismantled. Looking back, there were probably warning signs that it was about to be dismantled, but I was a mother to three young children and didn't necessarily see those signs off the get-go. Mm-hmm. But Donald was a photographer for the Department of National Defense. And as such, he traveled to remote areas on ships and whatnot to document scientific research. So he had been away for 4 weeks, and he was somewhere on a boat off the coast of Florida. And I was at home with the three kids, and conversations and communication was limited, so that it wasn't just like texting or like it, I didn't have continual communication with him. And we had a couple of conversations that were somewhat alarming, and I didn't go to any place where I thought he was like had health concerns or anything. They were just really weird exchanges. Mm. And when he came home from his trip with work, he was so sick and tired that like he could hardly keep his eyes open. So I thought initially, I was just like, this trip has just done him in. He's been on a boat for 4 weeks. He's a mess. And a day or two passed, and I was like, okay, something's wrong. So we went to the ER, and they kind of did some tests, and they didn't really see any issues. So they sent us back home, and the doctor at the ER had said, if anything changes, like, just bring him back in. And it was only a matter of a couple of days later where he fell in the shower. And I was alarmed and went to try and assist him. And he said something to me that didn't make any sense. So my instant thought was like, is he having a stroke? Like, is something like that happening? So we drove back to the ER and he was instantly sick to his stomach and not making sense. And they took us in. It was probably around 11 o'clock at night. My memory's foggy a little bit from those days, but they took him for a CAT scan and a doctor came back and like motioned to me to follow him and basically sat me down in a room and said that Donald's CAT scan had found multiple, like 40 tumors in his brain.
Wow.
And he didn't even call it cancer. He said white spots. And I remember just staring at him and I just felt like the bottom of like the ground drop away from me. I was just there by myself and there was a doctor and a nurse in the room. And it was just like, I just felt the life like draining from me.
And what was Donald's reaction?
Well, at that time, like he was so ill at that time that he wasn't even awake. So he was in his own room in the ER and they were, I guess, probably administering some kind of steroid to reduce swelling in his brain. So he pretty much slept for the whole night. They had told me the news. I was there in the hospital room with him by myself. I remember feeling so cold and not being able to sleep and knowing that I had to tell him the next morning and not knowing if he would be able to understand what was happening.
Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, I know that all of a sudden when things change that quickly, everything becomes muddy.
Yes.
And it's wading through mud. It's seeing through mud. Is that the experience that you had?
Yes, it was very muddy. And also because of the nature of his diagnosis and the fact that, you know, like he had left weeks ago as a seemingly healthy man. And then I didn't even know if he was comprehending things that we were speaking about. Like it was just, I think I mentioned to you the other day, like I felt it was so cruel because it was muddy and I was quickly forced to become his advocate, mm-hmm. and his caregiver and also feeling very, very uncertain in the future, what the diagnosis meant, just my identity, everything.
Mm-hmm. And did you know at this time that it was going to be a terminal illness?
I absolutely knew it would be a terminal illness, but I had no idea at how rapid the deterioration would be. So he got his diagnosis on May 22nd and he died on July 9th. So it was about a six week span. And that span included a surgery on his brain because they wanted to, and in actuality, Kelly, the tumors were a result of metastasized melanoma. So he had melanoma that went undiagnosed that had moved to his brain. So they did surgery to biopsy and that sort of thing on his brain. So we spent days in the hospital. We went through 2 weeks of whole head radiation during that period. So about 3 weeks of those 6 weeks were in the hospital. And then, yeah, time at home and watching him kind of like it impacted everything from his memory to his like he had nerve pain in his arms in his legs. He lost his taste buds, like just yeah. Mm. But I didn't know. I mean, I was young. I had no idea. I didn't know. I was in disbelief or denial or whatever. It was a first for me. So I didn't know what to expect.
And it's such a fast, that's a fast time to get your head around everything.
It's a fast time. And I know I'm pretty certain that that whole time I would have been in, like I wasn't diagnosed, but I'd have to say I was in shock. And that shock continued to stay with me for quite a period after he died.
Mm-hmm. And on top of everything else, then you also have, you are the caregiver to your best yes. friend.
Yes.
But then you can't just collapse into that because you have three small kids.
I have three small kids and they need me too.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm torn between time spent with them, having my family come or take kids, you know, back over to PEI, the flexibility to spend time at the hospital or what time I had to be back or, you know, that sort of thing. The kindness of others, which was fantastic, but like multiple people coming into our home or dropping off meals. Like there was layers and layers of management, calls coming from oncology doctors that I'd never spoken to, nurses telling me how to talk to the kids about grief. Like it was very, very overwhelming.
That's a lot coming at you.
It was a lot.
Yeah. What, I mean, the boys were 5 and 4.
Yeah. The Cooper turned 4 just a month or two after Donald died. So they would have been like 5, 3, almost 4, and 1 almost 2 at the time.
And how did they process it?
They're still processing it.
Right.
And I had some really fantastic friends and support and family at the time. So I think through all of it, they knew how loved they were. Of course, adults provided them with distractions and outings and suckers and, you know, everything that people could do to try and take some of the pain or painful memories, I guess, away. So I think initially it would seem like they did okay because they were kept moving and kept busy. Mm-hmm. But a very wise counselor told me, like, Jill, they're going to experience grief as they reach different developmental milestones, right? So here it is, 8 years after Donald died, and my daughter Darcy, like this past Sunday was Father's Day, and she had a huge meltdown. Like it was very unexpected, but she was like, because it's Father's Day and I don't have a dad and I never will. And it was just like, oh my God, because like we enter into these moments, like sometimes they're predictable. That one that day, for whatever reason, wasn't, because we've gone through Father's Days, like, you know, year after year. Right. But yeah, we never quite know what's coming. So yeah, I'd say that we continue to process grief.
And that's very interesting with Darcy, because she really wouldn't have a memory of him.
She would not have a memory of him. Nope. And I try my best to keep memories, it's not just memories, like to explain to them who their dad was, right, and what he was about, or what he liked or what he didn't. And even just things about his humor. I'm feel like it's my job to continue to help them have that connection to him.
Mm-hmm. What do you see in the kids of Donald? Like, you know, when you look at them.
Physically, I see his face. I see his mannerisms, his facial expressions all the time, which initially was very painful to me. I didn't see it as a gift initially. It was just kind of like, I can only explain, like there's certain things that catch me almost in my stomach. I can feel, I don't know whether it's anxiety. I don't know. Anyway, initially it was off-putting, but now I see it's a gift. They have his humor. They have his stubbornness. My oldest son Rowan, I would say, has his sometimes he thinks the rules don't apply to him, which is also another Donaldism. His love of pickles, sports, Montreal Canadiens. So yeah, there's lots of things, and lots of times, like I had said to you, like there's things that they do that they didn't learn, like that are just so like Donald, like exactly like Donald, that it's almost amazing to see that it's in their genes, like that it wasn't a learned behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think it might be a little bit learned if you see it in the older kids, but with youngest, so crazy. Can you tell me the story about when you were taking Darcy out of the bathtub?
I can.
I find that's a wonderful story.
Well, Darcy was in, this was so after Donald died, and like I sometimes time periods are a little bit gray for me. It's kind of like before dawn. I judge everything. Like years can kind of flow into one. So mm-hmm. I don't know exactly how old Darcy was. I'm going to guess she was about 3. So maybe it was like within a year after Donald died. And we were in our house here on the island and she was in the tub. And I had taken her out of the bathtub and wrapped her in a towel. And I was down on my knees and I kind of like hugged her into me, like drying her off. And she whispered in my ear, "Daddy's here." And it was like, I can't even explain the feeling I first felt. It was almost terrifying for a second.
Yeah.
Because I just was like, what? Like, what? And I kind of like held her back away from me and looked in her face again. And then she just said it so peacefully and calmly again, "Daddy's here." And I was like, "He is." And it was incredible to just experience that with her. Mm-hmm. I called my best friend Denise, who's like a very spiritual person. And she kind of talked me, not that I was on a ledge, but like it was very like I've gone through a lot of unique moments with my kids as on my own. So yeah, I reach out to my support circle often. So she just allowed me to see the beauty that was that moment.
But what a shock for it to come from that source.
I know.
Yeah. So let's go back to Donald in his final days. Was this something, because, you know, you're a young couple, you were in your 30s. So when I say that's even the word widow sounds strange to me to apply it to a young person. I know it happens all the time, but it seems that should be a woman who's been married for 40 or 50 years and had a lifetime of marriage and a partnership. But when you look at this time frame and you think about all that you've gone through, is it hard for you to even now think of, like we say, before Donald, after Donald, it hard for you to even imagine your life at that time now that you're moved away from it?
Oh, absolutely. I still have moments now, 8 years later, where a memory or a thought, like an experience comes back to me that I had never acknowledged, like since then,
right.
That I was just like, oh my God, how did I even get through that? Or moments or interactions with people. Mm-hmm. And then there's other things that are like deeply ingrained in my brain that I wish I didn't have there that I could somehow dump and get rid of. But yeah, I don't know how we did it in certain times. It was just like, okay, here we go. When I look back and I think like, I don't have any real insight into this, but like the way the information kind of came out from the doctor, like I almost felt like they were just giving me what I could handle in little, like, here's a little bit more, here's a little bit more. Right. Or else I might've just exploded maybe.
Yeah, it's a lot. And so in Donald's final days, mm-hmm. you were with him when he died?
Actually, I wasn't with Donald when he died, which is a big, I mean, if I'm going to be totally forthcoming, it's something I went to counseling over.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I didn't realize this all this time. I always thought that you were with him.
No, I wasn't with him. I was with him, like, I was with him in all the moments, but I wasn't with him in that very moment. And I guess when I look back, there was many moments I just didn't see what was coming. I didn't know it was the end. Even when like he had been at home and had a seizure at home and I didn't even know if it was do I call 911? Like, is everything going to be okay in a second? Like, I didn't even know how to respond. And even in that ambulance to the hospital, I still wasn't thinking Donald's going to die. Like, this isn't, I was thinking like, okay, this is a blip. This is a medicine. Like, I still didn't see that coming. And then we spent a couple of days in the hospital. I still didn't know it was coming. And then they came and talked to me and said, like, we're going to, move Donald to a palliative unit or whatever. And I think probably it was within a day of that. So like in my mind, palliative was a place where people went not for hours, you know, like it was, yeah. So I still wasn't there. And he had a day where he was very alert and funny and up and out of his bed. And then he had settled that evening and I was with him. You know, I gave him a kiss on the cheek and it was emotional just because I was leaving him. Like anytime when in those moments, I compare it to like maybe like a mothering feeling, like that you don't want to leave. So that was the moment. I knew I didn't want to leave him, but I never wanted to leave him. And then it wasn't until my phone rang at about 2 or 3 in the morning, and it was Donald's brother, Alan, who had spent the night there to call and tell me what had happened.
And how angry were you?
I think I was initially, anger was the feeling I had. Just because it took away, I felt like it took away some of my peace. I just would have wanted to have been there. I supported Donald in all of the moments, and I felt like I had let him down, and not knowing that I was even letting him down. So I lived with that for a while. I think as I look back now, I mean, I love Alan. He was trying to protect me, mm-hmm. and trying to take care of me. So his intentions were good. So I let go of the feelings, mm-hmm. but I had a wide range of emotions at that time.
Of course. I mean, we hear about those stages of grief, but you know, it's not necessarily in any particular order.
No, it's all muddy. Mm-hmm. I've read the stuff and whatever, but I don't know that it's like that. I don't know that people really move through things like that. I think maybe there's an advancement and then there's 2 steps back, and maybe it doesn't take them quite as long to get back to where they were, but then there's another, like it's back forth. Mm-hmm. And to this day, like if somebody just met me now, I think they might not even know what I had gone through. They might not know how significant that was to me. That being said, I can still experience something that can be quite a trigger and make me feel like I'm dead in the center of that again.
Mm-hmm. So everything changes. The rug is pulled out. Suddenly you're looking to relocate, I guess is the only way I can put it. And yeah. You had a life in Halifax in Nova Scotia. You had friends and some relatives, but that's not where you could stay.
No, it wasn't where I could stay. I needed my parents. Mm-hmm. I needed the familiarity of home. I don't even know if I knew what I needed. I just knew I couldn't be there. Mm-hmm. And it had been my home. I had lived like there for 17 or 18 years, but it no longer felt like my home. Donald was my home.
So Jill, one of the important things in dealing with loss is knowing when and that you have to ask for help. And so many people don't realize that.
Yes, I would have been one of those people. I wasn't comfortable ever in my life asking for help or accepting help. And I don't know when I think back, I don't know if I actually was able to clearly ask for help or if my close circle just knew I needed help and were kind of helping me put one foot in front of the other. I did get a lot of help. I got a lot of support. Mm-hmm. And that kept me going. I think also, I also got help that maybe sometimes overwhelmed me. So I think as that process went on, maybe I needed, or I learned more, I guess I learned more specifically how to ask for the help I needed.
Right.
But it wasn't instant. It wasn't learned behavior. It was just kind of realizing like, oh, that actually caused me more stress than the help it provided. Mm-hmm. Maybe next time I'll ask if they can do this right. sort of thing. So yeah, it was a big eye opener.
Is there anything within that then that you have learned now that if someone needed, you know, someone is newly going into this, that you can say to the person this is going to be important to you? Or is it just that everything is so different and random?
I think that there are commonalities, but I think we all process things differently. I think somebody who may be a mom to small children would have different needs and appreciate different supports than, you know, somebody who's 80 years old might, or whatever. So I think the needs are varied. But I think that, like, we could assume that, like, people's basic needs may need taken care of. So, like, ensuring that they have food when they perhaps are not in a state of mind to, you know, do that, that their fridge has some options in it, that basic things around their house or yard or whatever might be taken care of, that they are able to have some downtime or just some moments of relaxation. But I think it is an individual thing. I remember speaking with a lady. It was after Donald died, and she said to me, and I'm not even religious, but she said, "Can I pray for you?" And I said, "Yeah, okay, yeah, you can pray for me and the kids." And then she looked me right in the eyes and she's like, "What would you like me to pray on?" And I was just staring at her because no one had ever asked me that before. But I thought, what a unique question, and how powerful it was that she was going to, you know, spend time thinking about us and asking me specifically, what is it that I can pray on? So yeah, just things like that. There's these moments that pop in my head. Like, it was like, that was profound that person did that, or this person helped. I remember a friend sending pizza from the Cayman Islands to me and my kids on Canada Day. Another woman sent me a huge basket full of, like, school snacks for the kids. There was just these things that were like, oh my God. So it was just the stuff, like the details, and that people's kindness and care were just like moving forward to take the decisions away from me, or whatever it might be, the mindless stuff. And what's so much appreciated.
What should people not do? You probably had a few things too.
Oh my goodness. I think we just have to take the cues from the person or persons, like the people that are grieving. Somebody might be like, you know, a really social person and maybe not want to spend any time on their own. They really value the company of someone, where someone else might just need to, like, sleep and get showered and be by themselves or whatever. So I think there is that stuff. One thing that is a big eye opener for me is that, like, I struggled for a long time after Donald died. And I think that we often make the mistake of assuming that someone is okay, that the grief and service and, you know, a few weeks has passed or whatever, they seem to be doing all right. I think that we should not make those assumptions. And I would be forced to do certain routines, like, you know, go to the grocery store and get food. And people would look at me, and I think, if I was just standing upright and had taken time to put lipstick on, people just assumed that I was okay. Right. Like, I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you're doing it. That's another thing. Don't say that to people. They don't know how they're doing it either. They don't have any explanation. And most of the times they'd say, I'm doing it because I have to,
right,
or maybe they're doing it and not even remembering they're doing it. So those sort of things.
And that's a really good point to make, because, and we've talked about this before, where, you know, people say a lot because we don't know what else to say, "Oh my God, you are so brave."
Right.
And did you feel brave?
No, I didn't feel brave. Brave would have been like, okay, you have two scenarios. One, you can go through this, or two, you can go through this. And I picked the hardest one and was like, yeah, put me on that. I'm going to face that. I didn't have any choice. There was no choice. Mm-hmm. And that is the biggest, that's probably, like, I never looked back and thought, like, oh, I had a lot of anger or anything. And I still don't think I did, but I definitely had a feeling like I didn't get to choose, that life became about reacting. And in moments still to this day where I feel like I'm in those situations, it makes me uncomfortable, because it's like, no, I'm not doing this. I want to choose. So no, I wasn't brave. I mean, maybe I put on a brave face. My kids, I wanted to be perceived as maybe brave or knowing what I was doing for them. Mm-hmm. But no, I wasn't brave. I didn't do anything heroic or anything that I think most people wouldn't do. And people would be like, oh my God, if I was you, I wouldn't have even been able to get out of bed. And like, finally I had the courage to say to somebody, like, I wake up in my bed and for about 30 seconds, I look out the window and feel peaceful. And then I remember what the reality of my life actually is. And I can literally feel the heaviness from the top of my head to my toes as it comes over me. But then I hear a kid crying and I have no choice but to get up. So it was never an option. I didn't feel it was an option.
Yeah, because you don't have that. You can't stay and put the covers over your head.
No.
When you have to feed children.
No, they kept, I'm grateful for them for a million reasons, but the forced routine and caring for them was a big part of my healing. Or just like functioning. I'll say functioning.
Yeah.
The healing took a long time, but yeah.
So when you look back and it's been 8 years, mm-hmm. and it's, as you said, it's still a process and will always be so. But when you look back at that road behind you, did you ever think you'd be here right now?
No, I did not think I would be here. And in the early days, I had a hard time. Like, Kelly, I couldn't even make a plan for like 3 days out. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't know. I mean, I wasn't thinking my life was going to be over, but like, I couldn't dream. I couldn't think like, oh yeah, I'm going to do that. I couldn't commit to, do you want to do a trip? Like, everything made me anxious. Nothing made me. Yeah. I never thought that I'd be here. And I think, I had mentioned this to you when we moved on to our house on Greensview Drive, the boys were getting on the bus the first day of school. I was holding Darcy in my arms, and one of my new neighbors, she was really kind and sweet, but she basically said, like, you know, it won't be long before she's getting on the bus. And normally, like in a person that wasn't grieving, that would have been like a statement that would have been like, I know, and whatever. But that statement, it just hung on my shoulders. Because in that moment, like, I couldn't have possibly imagined that we would ever make it to the day that Darcy was old enough to start school. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I could hardly focus on what was coming at the end of the week. I had no vision that, yeah, you're going to go on to do this and you're do this and your kids are going to be in junior high. And yeah, I had no vision of that at all.
Is it a gradual thing, or do you ever have a pinpointed moment where you can say, wow, I'm coming through this?
I think that I had those moments throughout the journey, mm-hmm. Because I think it is a huge process. And I think I showed, or I was aware of advancements I had made kind of throughout the process. Now, like the first, it's ugly and it's messy. Like, I remember crying on the phone with the power company when they were like, is there anybody else's name on the bill? And it was just like, like the most, just whatever. But that, like, that day that hit me, that I was just like, you know, no. So like in the early days, everything like that was a disaster. And then I started to feel like, okay. And maybe I started to take better care of myself, or I realized the benefits of walk, or like whatever it might be. So there were stages along the way. But every stage that I got to made me kind of reflect like, oh, I thought I'd come so far then, but mm-hmm. now I'm here, and so on and so forth. And that's like, I still do that.
Yeah. And when we go through grief, then there comes the step of reclaiming joy.
Yes.
And I think there's so many things associated that come with that too, is there's the guilt for feeling joy. I guess perhaps that's what they call survivor's guilt, but did you have any of that?
I don't know if I had survivor's guilt. It took me a long time to experience joy. Mm-hmm. But at a point, like, I realized, and like, I felt very certain in the fact, like, that Donald would not want me to live a life this way, because this is my only life. Like, if anything, I should learn, we should all, like, he died too young. It was so unfair. There was no stopping that. Like, it just, like, so not knowing when my end is coming, like, how could I continue to live in the gray, in the dark? I had to find it for me and for my kids.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it safe for me to say that before Donald, your first love was music?
I would say music was a big love. I did probably, there was one other before Donald. He was actually a musician. Oh, those musicians. I'm teasing. It was the guy that I fell in love with during dinner theater days, way, way, way back.
Right.
Anyway, but Donald was my real true love.
Right.
Yeah.
But you were able to get that. Did you ever think you'd go back to singing?
No, I did not really think I'd go back to singing. Like, once I started to become a mother, like, when, as mothering and parenting and all that sort of stuff, and the responsibilities of home ownership, like, I just kind of started to chart a different path, mm-hmm, way back. But I will tell you this, on a drive to, we were almost coming to the McKay Bridge, and I was taking Donald to one of his radiation sessions, and we had stopped at Tim Hortons, and he was super confused because they didn't have pancakes at Tim Hortons. And I was just like, Donald, they don't have pancakes here. Like, we can get a muffin, whatever. So most of our drive didn't make sense. And as we were about to be at the bridge, I said, I really am missing singing. Maybe I'll get back to it. And in this moment of just total clarity, he looked at me and he's just like, it's never too late. And that, those words stayed with me because when I finally decided to pick my guitar up again and start singing, like, I knew that he was right, and I knew that I would do it for him.
Right. And you've been writing songs, and that's been very therapeutic.
Yes. I started to just, like, enjoy the company of my guitar again after a lot of years, mm-hmm, probably because in those early times after he died, like, I was at home with the kids by myself and they'd go to bed and the guitar was a great outlet for me. Mm-hmm. And at a point I started to be able to sing or speak or write the words that I perhaps wasn't brave enough to say in my everyday life. And the more I wrote, the more I healed, I think. Mm-hmm. And the more I was willing to share my music with people, the more I felt genuine connections with others, mm-hmm, because perhaps they could relate. I think that music is a great language, a connector for people. And when I started to post videos on Facebook, like, I had people reach out from, like strangers reach out from different parts of the world just to say they experienced this, or their husband went through something similar, or whatever it might be. So yeah, grief, as painful as it can be, if we are willing to be raw and honest about what we are going through, I wish more people would do it. I think it can be so isolating. Mm-hmm. There's so many different things that people endure through life, and we don't talk about it. We don't share what's really going on, and we do become more and more isolated. I don't think grief needs to be that way. I don't think anything should be that way. I think that we should just know, like, this is not your fault, or this is not unique to you, or whatever it is, and take those connections and those joys. Maybe we'd become healthier people faster.
And I guess then you're a very good advocate for finding, to reclaim joy, finding something that you love to do.
Absolutely. Life, I mean, we hear it all the time, life's too short. I go through, especially after this pandemic, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Like, so many joyless days, right? For so many of us, yes. I think. And that feeling of isolation. So, like, life is not meant for that stuff. I fall victim to it too, still knowing and living what I've gone through, mm-hmm, that it becomes mundane or just, like, kind of blah or grumpy or angry days or whatever. But yeah, we have to find the joy. Mm-hmm. We owe it to ourselves.
So would you be up for sharing a song with us?
Yes, I will share a song with you. I will do my best. I'm going to grab my guitar.
Sure.
And I don't want to be too close to you. this is a song, and I wrote a bunch of songs after Donald died. And this one that I'm going to play, this one is called Make These Memories. And I think, like, when I think back to my life with Donald, I was just perfectly content with him in the simplest of things. It was joyful being around home or making a meal or having a bonfire or just whatever. Like, he loved his feet in the grass or at the beach. We had so many positive experiences in just kind of regular life. And I think that we can often go around looking for the big things, the celebrations, the things we anticipate or you know, look forward to. But for me, missing him, it was the moments, like just the simplest of things. And sadly, they're not always the things that you can recall as easily, because they're just like, that was just your normal life, right? So how did he look when we, like, so yeah, I wrote this song and it's called Make These Memories. You're like, enough rambling, Jill.
Place is packed. I feel your hand on my back. You are the one. You are my world. You are my man. I am your girl. And I'd give almost anything to be that girl again. We're in the car, radio song. It's Patsy Cline, I sing along. Winds in our hair, we're young and free. You rest your hand on my knee. I'd give almost anything to drive away with you. Slow down. Relax, cut to make this moment last. Sometimes I feel you here with me. Chin up, don't cry. Can't let this life pass you by. If you can't be anything, just be. It's getting late. Our friends go home, just you and me, all alone. I look around, I love this place. We say goodnight, you kiss my face. I'd give almost anything to feel that kiss again. Slow down. Relax, got to make this moment last. Sometimes I feel you here with me. Chin up, don't cry. Can't let this life pass you by. If you can't be anything, just be. Everything's changing, life's rearranging. What the hell am I supposed to do? I've got to be strong. I'll keep singing my song. I'm gonna sing it loud for you. The time's come. Say goodbye. We both wiped tears from our eyes. I can't believe you have to go. I loved you more than you could know. I'd give almost anything to say those words to you. Slow down. To make these moments last. Sometimes I feel you're here with me. let this life pass you by. If you can't be anything, just be. Slow down, relax. Got to make these memories last.
Oh boy.
How's that?
Well, I think you got me.
Oh, Kelly.
Oh my. It's such a beautiful song, and knowing the story behind it makes it even more so, I think. But how does it feel for you when you perform that?
I think the further I get away from writing it, like all the music was really like raw when I first started performing it. Mm-hmm. And like a grieving woman was who I was for a long time, right? So it was very... like it was who I was. Mm-hmm. I think as the years go by and I have more distance and more clarity, the songs are still extremely meaningful, and as is my love for Donald. Mm-hmm. But they're not as raw for me anymore. So right. I can sing them with a little bit of detachment, but sometimes I might find myself on a stage and it just hits me. Or there could be other situations, or watching a friend, like it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It just depends on the day.
Yeah,
Kelly.
Really?
Like everything with me.
Absolutely. But here's the thing is that life goes on. And
yes.
And so you can definitely attest to that. And how it does and how it unfolds and how it happens and how you get through it is kind of the mystery. But there's kind of this little second chance here in, especially, you know, in your story. And that is in the form of Kevin.
Yes.
And so Jill Chandler has found love again.
Yes.
In this lifetime. And you're engaged.
Yes.
And I know that you never thought you'd be there.
No. No. I think when I look back when I was a kid, I don't know that I ever, like, I have friends that like were planning weddings when they were teenagers, mm-hmm. you know, like they pictured that stuff. I never pictured it for myself once. So imagining it twice is unexpected for sure. Mm-hmm. But Kevin did come into my life at a time that I was ready again to give and receive love. Right. I wasn't in that place for the longest of times, even though friends suggested like go on a date, you know, whatever. I knew that I wasn't ready. And I probably, if you ask Kevin, he would maybe say that I still wasn't ready when we met. But I, again, had felt I'd come so far, and I had come so far. But that being said, there's going to be some steps back in life too. And I would say that I'm very grateful for the chance to love again. And I would also say that that going through the pain that I did and my family did, like, I think for a time period, I thought like, we've gotten through it. Life is going to be easy from here on out. But that is a joke. Like, life is not easy. Just because we made it through that doesn't mean that there's not going to be other challenges that come our way. Mm-hmm. I would say that I still maneuver through life with things that come on my plate that may be overwhelming, or moments that I'm like, really? I don't even. So yeah, I'm happy that I've had the chance to love again. Mm-hmm. But I think that life is hard for all of us. And Kevin has brought a lot of joy. Mm-hmm. But maneuvering through a relationship with somebody who, you know, had a previous marriage and previous kids and it's not textbook, or I don't even know if that's how you describe it. Like it's a continual work in progress.
Of course. But you also, I mean, that's a big thing on his part to be able to take that on, because Donald is very much present.
Yes.
And I love that you, I mean, obviously you have children and this is very important, but you know, you have said to me before, when Donald died, I was still madly in love with him.
Absolutely. I was.
And so to get to that other place where you still hold a space for Donald, you still celebrate Donald.
Right. And
Kevin has to be there for that and handle that.
Yes, he does. And he does do that. And I think, like, when I said, like, I was madly in love with Donald when he died. And I stayed that way for a long time. And it was painful for me to, you know, when I got to the place where I removed my wedding band and that sort of thing. Like, there's these steps that I think that people go through. And it was like, you know, when you have, oh, exciting news, I got a call, you know, like Donald was my person. So it took a very long time for me to even not be in the habit that he was the person I needed to talk to, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an evolution. So I never fell out of love with Donald, I can't even explain it, Kelly. I'm not doing a very good job.
No, yeah.
It's time passes and it just becomes less and less raw. And also your brain and logic kick in, that this is not like, nope, that's not who you call. And so maybe instead I call my mom or I text a friend or whatever. Your habits change and you are adapting. Mm-hmm. And I guess through those adaptations to try and bring yourself to a healthier level, then maybe your heart opens to what might come.
Right. And it's a big thing, you know, in that you're introducing this person into your life, into your heart, into your children's lives.
Yeah, it's huge.
How are the kids with everything?
I think that continues to be a work in progress.
Right.
They love Kevin. They love him and he loves them. But there is a peace, you know?
Yeah. And that's something that's just part of your puzzle.
Yes.
Right.
So many puzzles, Kelly.
Oh boy. I'll tell you. And you're also, you've been back on stage and you're performing and the really thing that always just tugs at my heart is that Darcy has been coming up and singing with you.
Yes. She has taken up, I'm biased, but like she is a very natural singer and musician. Mm-hmm. She's had no training and Santa brought her ukulele the Christmas before last and she just picked it up. And the fact that she can accompany herself, like, and she decides she wants to learn a tune and she does it. And she'll come out and sing and I'm just like, oh my God. So yeah, it started because she learned, one of the songs that I do is Hallelujah. And she started to learn that on the ukulele. And one night I just heard her wailing on this. Like she was just, it was mind blowing how good it was. So I decided, yeah, next gig, you're going to come up and sing with me. And she doesn't, like, it doesn't even faze her. She's 9. She's on a stage, like people watching her, strangers. And she just gives it. So yeah, it's been a real joy for me to have her come up on stage.
Absolutely. And how much would Donald love this?
Oh, he'd be over the moon. He'd be so over the moon. Donald was really proud of my singing. I remember this is just to show you Donald's humor. I shouldn't even say this on the podcast, but but I will. I don't even know who's listening, but like I will just tell you.
So do it.
We were at a family wedding and the wedding ceremony and dinner and all that had happened. And it was at this lovely, lovely place at PEI and there was access to a beach. So after kind of the initial, you know, wedding night ended, we all went down to the beach and had a bonfire and continued to have drinks and all that sort of stuff. And I brought my guitar down and I played several songs, but one of the songs I played was Bobby McGee, like Janis Joplin's Bobby McGee, which is a real, like, throat, like you have to give your whole heart and soul. And I finished I finished playing and people clapped and cheered. And Donald in his silly humor way, he's like, "Can I sleep with that girl?" So he loved the music and the stage and he always encouraged me in my songs. And he was a music lover as well. I don't know if people would know that about him, but he was like, had a really broad, he could listen to classical music, or the band, like whatever. He loved music. And I still have this satchel, like this big bag that has all of his mixtapes and tapes that he made. I'll always have them. I don't have any way to play them right now, but we'll keep those forever. Nice. So yeah, to see Darcy have a love of music would have made him very proud.
Yeah. So now in the journey where you are right now, where are you right now?
I feel in some ways the living through the pandemic has been a reminder of grief for me at different points. In some ways it was, this will maybe put people off, but in some ways, initially it was almost comforting because I felt like the rest of the world knew what it was like to wake up and have a sense of dread come over them. In those initial days when we were like, you can't leave your house and all that sort of stuff, I felt like everyone was like grieving. And that for me felt like, okay, now we're all on even footing here. But I think now I'm watching a friend go through a very painful time, as her husband is terminally ill. And I am relieved. I'm inspired by her and her strength. And I am proud of myself, I guess, in the journey that I've gone through, that I can now be a support person for her and instinctively know what she may need, mm-hmm. or want, or have the comfort to talk about things that are not so nice, and just be at ease. So I guess, yeah, I'm all over the map most days, Kelly. For the most part, I feel like I'm through the grieving process. But like I said, Father's Day, like there's things,
yeah,
there's things that come up, and I'll always do my very best to honor Donald and have his kids know who he was, and hopefully instill pride in them as to who they are and where they've come from.
Is there anything in closing that you would want to say to anyone who was coming through this process now, who's just been gone through that shock of loss?
There's so much that I'd want to say to them. I would want to say that they should be kind to themselves. I would want to say that they may carry guilt or questions, that the quicker they come to a place of acceptance as to what has happened, the better suited they will be to move forward. I would want them to know that, like for me, I had a lot of different symptoms, like in the initial weeks after grief, like after Donald died, like I couldn't even sit and read a book. I had trouble with comprehending things. I had trouble with memory, sleep, overwhelmed of decision-making. Like it changed a lot of who I was and a lot of my identity. So I would think that it's typical that people go through the loss of their loved one and potentially the loss of themselves for a period. And I think that the recovery, part of the recovery is on deciding who you are going to be again and how you want to perceive the world, what you're going to tolerate, what you're going to stand for, like all those things. So as painful and ugly as it is, there's going to be gifts that come to you in the form of friendships or the things you might be willing to say yes to again or whatever it is. And sadly, like we're all going to face these things, you know. Loss is a human experience. And the more open we are to talking about it, and what a great job you are doing to draw attention and to different people's experiences. I'm proud of you.
And I'm proud of you, my friend. And I know that it's a raw subject, but I think that this, as you say, it's really important, and it's important that we have these conversations so that, you know, we can be helpful, but also not so alone.
Correct.
Right. And so I will say thank you. I'm very grateful for you to be able to talk about this today and to share it and to talk about Donald.
I'm grateful that you gave me this opportunity. I didn't think I'd be emotional but at times I was.
Mm-hmm.
But I am, well, it's a safe environment to do that with you. And I appreciate all your kindness and support. And again, thank you for shedding light and giving a platform to people like me to talk about these things. I thank the world of you.
Now we're going to get mushy. So I guess.
So let's cut this off right now.
Cut it off. We've been speaking with Jill Chandler from Prince Edward Island. And Jill, thank you again. And good luck with everything and keep making music.
Thank you.
This conversation is brought to you by the When You Die Project. From existential afterlife questions to palliative care and the nuts and bolts of green burial, if it has to do with death, we're talking about it. WhenYouDie.org.